Everyone is able to hear me. So it's a real pleasure to welcome everyone to today's Friday seminar and especially to introduce our speaker, Professor Nayanika Mathur from the University of Oxford School of Anthropology and Museum Ethnography. She's an anthropologist of South Asia with wide-ranging research interests in the anthropology of politics, development, environment, law, and human-animal studies. Her first monograph, Paper Tiger, Law, Bureaucracy, and the Developmental State in Himalayan India, was published in 2016 by Cambridge University Press. This book won the Sharon Stephens Prize awarded by the American Ethnological Society for a first book. This book analyzes the workings of the state in a remote area of India. Mathur argues that the problem of the implementation of law in India is about the way in which the social life of official documents produce a strange combination of effect and effect. Mathur's talk today builds on her more recent research on human-big cat conflict in India, on which she has written a monograph, which is titled Group Cats, Beastly Encounters in the Anthropocene. The book is currently in press and will be published by the University of Chicago Press this summer. And I must say, I cannot wait to read the book. I really look forward to this talk and reading the book. But it's really excellent that we can get the foretaste of this book today through her talk. And the title of her paper today is Entrapment, New Ways of Seeing Big Cats in India. Welcome, the floor or Zoom is yours.
Thank you so much, Sirpa, for this really kind introduction and for the invite. Thank you very much to Sarah as well for the invitation. I'm really excited to be here and well on Zoom on Helsinki Anthropology, and I hope in the future we can actually do this face to face. So I'm going to just share my screen. Also, please let me know if my voice is okay. I am in India and this is sort of the best Wi-Fi I can get, but it does sort of sometimes drop in and out. So apologies if that happens. I'm going to be showing some images of some research. Okay, so exactly as Sirpa said, this is actually a chapter from my forthcoming book, which is out in the summer. This is the book is called Crooked Cats. It basically is, it's kind of a strange book in a way because it is based on about 15 years of fieldwork, starting off with my doctoral research back in 2006 and my postdoctoral research. Again, most of it in the Indian Himalaya, but also in the cities of Mumbai and Shimla and in Rajasthan. So it's sort of a bit more scattered all over India. The central sort of focus of the book is basically trying to understand how humans and big cats how do they share space in very sort of narrow, within sort of in close proximity to one another. So this is really primarily about how humans live with leopards, but also with tigers, but primarily with leopards in spaces like the Himalaya, where, you know, actually there is quite a big population of big cats who live around you, etc. And the book is trying to understand that ethnographically, historically, and also just trying to think about this through the prism of the Anthropocene in some ways. So it's a strange beast, so to say. But what I'm talking about today is actually one chapter which comes towards the end of the book, which is drawn largely from my fieldwork in a few big cities in India. I'm not going to name the cities for reasons that are going to become a bit obvious towards the end of the talk, I hope. But it's basically the question I ask in this chapter is that how are we in urban India actually encountering big cats? How are we seeing them? And this is basically about the visuals through which we encounter big cats and what are the social, political, legal effects of that. So I'm going to read because I know I have between 40 to 45 minutes and this is a longish and slightly convoluted chapter. So I'm just going to read it out at the moment. Okay. So these, as I said, let me know if it comes here. So this paper forges connections between the visceral emotions that emerge from, from new ways of seeing non-human animals and the remaking of ethical legal formations. It all began with a field trip in 2015 to a very big city in India. I had accompanied a group of people who were involved in a new camera trapping project to the sites where the equipment had been set up. Camera traps are these extremely sensitive, high-tech infrared cameras, which basically track movement, or they pick up they have the sensors that allow you to see, you know, to basically take an image when there is any movement about it. I'm going to be talking a bit about camera trapping in this and the technology behind it in a minute. But basically, this all began with this field trip to the city where we were involved in this camera trapping exercise. Now, these camera traps, because they were owned by a very wealthy Western organization with the resources to purchase extremely high-tech, high-res cameras, this was a very sort of delicate operation. So at one point, a member of our group requested that I sit on a specific ledge so that he could take my photograph. Now, he was somewhat uncharacteristically very particular about the location and angle and even the tilt of my head. I nevertheless went ahead and posed as he made me do. He took the picture on his phone's camera and then, grinning, pulled out his tablet from his satchel. Opening a file, he juxtaposed the device next to the photograph he had taken of me just a few minutes ago on his phone and showed them both to me. So he picks out this iPad and then he shows me phone and he shows me two images of it. I let out a huge gasp of shock and everyone in our group burst into laughter. So what I was seeing was this image of a really big leopard who was sitting at the very same ledge that I was currently perched off. The date and time at the bottom of the tablet image showed it to be from 2 evenings back. So, you know, today is the 19th of March, this was the 17th of March, approximately around the same time, because again, I'm going to talk about it. You can see the timing of the image when it's taken. And somewhat in that moment, somewhat uncannily, the leopard had been captured in a manner that appeared to my shocked eye, very akin to my own slightly self-conscious pose. I still remember the chill that ran down my spine when I saw these two images side by side. Once the shock subsided, I too joined the rest of the group in laughing. Now, this paper is about such ghastly shock and horror. It is about chills down the spine, laughter, and even tears that are direct products of new technologies like camera traps, surveillance cameras, especially CCTVs, and smartphones that are aimed at capturing images of big cats. In this paper, I ask, what happens when we see a big cat through the medium of something like a camera trap photograph or CCTV footage? Means of observing and visually encountering big cats that are relatively new. Seen by many as the future of conservation, these new technologies for visually capturing animals are proliferating. In the process, they're unleashing a range of emotions from love and awe to revulsion and fury that are often overlooked in the technocratic desire to know more about our non-human counterparts. What also remains unremarked on is how new forms of secretive and elite knowledges are being created and how this raises troubling ethical questions of who comes to know what about our feline neighbors and who doesn't. These questions are quickly becoming tied to new legal pronouncements, the repercussions of which are potentially far-reaching. The technological means of seeing and thus feeling and knowing big cats are, I argue, deeply implicated in the production of emergent ethical legal regimes that might come to conclusively change our relationships with non-human animals. Many of the ethical conundrums and legal potentialities of the use of new visual technologies for entrapping non-humans are just on the cusp of emerging. There is no saying where and in what directions they will eventually lead. What I'm going to do here in this talk today is merely open out some of the ethical and legal questions that these new ways of seeing non-humans are posing. Now, seeing a big cat is perhaps the most direct way of knowing one. Donna Haraway early on analyzed images of primates in National Geographic magazine to argue that they were produced by race, gender-coded roles, capital, and empire. She reads the images through an analysis of the workings of the working of the magazine and the desire of the National Geographic Society to popularize science through depictions of travel and naked eye science, as she puts it, that converge readers into voyeurs. Bill Adams has more recently examined what he terms digital animals through the forms of data that tagging and other surveillance technologies open up about non-human animals. Importantly, he notes that the digitalization of animals may involve the creation of new digital lives which have no analog in nature. Now, Adams is concerned with how non-human nature is sensed no longer directly, but rather by the medium of technology, leading to a potential breakdown of the distinction between that which is animal and that which is machine. Now, in this paper, my interest is also in increasing sensing, a seeing of big cats via new digital technologies. However, this does not lead me to argue for the increasing domination of digital animals. On the contrary, I argued that these digital technologies produce a whole gamut of intense emotions that are silently but effectively shaping the near futures of the non-human. Now, if you look at the literature on, on the visualization of animals, what is striking is the foregrounding of their pain and suffering. So Peter Singer's path-breaking animal liberation, for instance, makes its argument against speciesism and for the ethical treatment of animals through texts that conjures disturbing images of the tyranny of humans over non-humans. Animal suffering is now being widely studied with, for instance, Barbara King, looking at animal emotions and animal grief through a study of various modalities, which include videotaped evidence, to argue along with scientists that, quote, more animal species think and feel more deeply than we've ever suspected, end of quote. Naisargi Dave, in her work with animal rights activists in India, has picked up on the recurring motif that activists identify of seeing and hearing the suffering of animals. Now, Dave is interested in thinking about the idea of witnessing as distinct from merely seeing. For her, to witness means to see in a manner that is present, to root themselves when they might rather run or turn away. Miriam Tichton has noted that the visualization of animal suffering in, on, or against border walls does manifest the deadliness of such walls for non-human animals, yet the compassion that non-human animals are able to evoke in photographs through a complex mix of innocence, cuteness, and individual suffering is not transferable to human subjects. So in short, there is a rich and a growing literature on the visualization of animals, especially on animal grieving or suffering in some way. But what I want to ask is, what about those moments when we see non-human animals, especially extremely elusive ones like big cats, in unexpected yet banal ways? In other words, what does it mean to see big cats not in pain or as victims of human depredations, but as very different kinds of beings? Very banal, everyday, nonchalant, just neighbors, just normal non-human animals that are just hanging around us. What does it mean to see that? Now, camera traps, and this is sort of an image of a camera trap, I'll just explain in a bit. Camera traps, smartphones, and security cameras are allowing for this form, this new form of seeing that I describe here as a form of entrapment. Now, a camera trap, so this is an image which was taken by a camera trap, team of us who worked in another city in India. And this is basically a camera trap is an automated digital device that takes a flash photo whenever movement of some form triggers its infrared sensor. They came into prominence in the late 1980s once the technology had been adequately developed. In India, camera traps are increasingly replacing pugmark monitoring, especially when it comes to taking censuses of tigers, leopards, and lions. If you don't know what pugmark monitoring is, we can talk about it in the Q&A. But I think the point I want to make here is that these cameras are becoming absolutely central to the way in which the Indian state, as well as conservationist groups here, are understanding or getting to know how big cats live. Now, the camera trap, as an article lauding its achievements of noted, has, quote, revolutionized wildlife research and conservation, enabling scientists to collect photographic evidence of rarely seen and often globally endangered species with little expense, relative ease, and minimal disturbance to wildlife, end of quote. Indeed, this is called digital conservation, is now all the rage, and camera trapping is particularly singled out as the future of conservation. Now, unlike radio collars or other forms of physical tagging devices, camera trapping is non-intrusive and provides all sorts of data ranging from animal habits and movements to population counts to, in some very remarkable cases, the identification of new species or the rediscovery of a species which has been thought to be extinct. For elusive animals, or those that are considered quote-unquote shy, camera trapping has proven to be a particular boon. It has allowed for the proliferation of an argument for seeing animals as they really are. These clandestine cameras are allowing us a peek into the animal kingdom in a manner that wildlife photography and documentary filmmaking, with their photoshopping, editing, as well as deliberate chasing and stalking of the subjects, has not been able to achieve thus far. Now, the benefits of camera trapping are generally tremendous. And you know, I'm not trying to at all undermine that. But in the conservation literature, there is a utilitarianism that underlies the seeing of endangered animals, especially the seeing of their so-called secret lives. The seeing becomes a means of better protecting them, not just from poaching and hunting, but also by devising new ways to make a space in the world where they can flourish. So, you know, this can range from captive breeding to marking out bigger protected territories. I mean, there's a whole sort of range of interventions that are happening, especially in the lives of endangered and extinct, you know, endangered big cats in South Asia, which again, we can talk more about in the Q&A perhaps. Yet, what I want to underline in this talk today is that the conservationist enthusiasm for new technologies misses out on the ethnographic side effects of these new practices of entrapment. These effects include, as I very briefly described at the beginning, vast shock or awe and excited or nervous laughter at the beholding of certain visuals. But they also include an elite secrecy, which is enjoined by the newfound knowledge of the hitherto hidden lives of big cats. There are sort of all sorts of new questions that are being opened up, ethical and political questions about whether we should share novel bits of information revealed by camera trapping exercises and with whom. Simultaneously, legal questions related to the copyright and ownership of these images and knowledges emerging, as we ponder the question of the legal personhood of the non-human. Now, the literature on digital conservation also elides what other forms of visualizing and seeing non-human animals are doing to human-animal relationships. Smartphones with their inbuilt cameras and capacity to upload files instantaneously to social media, and security cameras with their often accidental capturing of non-human animals, are distinct from the project of camera trapping. The former are amateur forms of photography or videography and do not, in general, have the intentionality of science or conservation behind them. The latter, that is camera trapping, is much more purposeful about using so-called scientific knowledge to better human-animal relationships, to prevent extinction, and to protect endangered species. Yet both the professional practice of camera trapping and the expansion of the use of surveillance cameras and smartphones share something critical. They're allowing us to see non-human animals and they're allowing us to capture the images in a way that is distinct from what has hitherto existed in the form of stylized hunting photo shoots or professional wildlife photography. Furthermore, the ethical issues that they're unleashing share much more in common than is immediately apparent. And so I think of these as new forms of entrapping non-human animals, and I'm going to study them in tandem here. So I make some differences between CCTVs and a camera trapping thing, but I want to sort of think about them in tandem together. Now, I'm going to have to skip like vast sections of this because this is slightly complicated sort of paper, etc. But one of the things I sort of want to talk about in the beginning, right at the beginning, is something that comes across very sharply in all my fieldwork, and this is basically this whole idea of, you know, when you encounter a big cat in the wild, the way in which the tiger, the lion, or the leopard will hold your gaze, will sort of hold your eyes, you know, and you see them in a particular way. And I think I'm going to sort of, you know, in all the narratives that this work is consists of, this whole book consists of, this idea of holding the gaze of the big cat is actually very important. And people have, the people who sort of live around tigers and leopards have told me many times. So the thing that you do not get from, say, an image like this one that I put up on the screen is that sense of sitting there and comes and walks past you and you hold its gaze and you see it and it looks at your eyes and there's this particular meaning and communication that happens in a moment that goes away. But what is sort of coming across is, you know, is sort of very different kinds of narratives and questions that are coming up. So I'm going to sort of begin with another case where this chapter begins strong, but also actually in many ways, even this book is sort of centered upon this project. Now, this goes back to the same city that I was doing my fieldwork in, and the same Western, extremely rich conservationist organization that was putting in these camera trap images in the city, were locating these camera traps. Now, one of the images they found, and I know all of this because I was actually working with the quote-unquote native photographers, who are the ones who are actually doing all the work of of finding spots, locating the camera trap, talking to people who live around there. There's a whole very complicated process that goes into laying a camera trap, which I'm not going to talk about here because I don't have time for it. But again, maybe something to discuss in the Q&A. And it's actually a very, very complex process, which is always done by people who are quote-unquote natives. So there's very much anthropological in the sense you're finding native knowledges where you seek them out, and they're the ones who sort of then give you the information through which you decide where to place the camera. Where does the tiger normally walk? What does it do? What's the right perch for it? How do we make sure that the camera is not stolen or it's not tampered with, etc.? There are all sorts of other things which go into this, which I'm going to skip here. What I'm going to talk about here are a few images and which these camera traps have produced, and then what happens to those images subsequently, and why I'm posing these questions of ethics and law and elite secrecy that comes in there. So there was an image, a series of images that I actually really wanted for the book cover, but I was not able to get my hands on them, even though I've seen these images many times and I've spoken to the actual photographers who placed the cameras which took those images. And I want to just talk about them a bit here because unfortunately I can't show them to you. I wish I could. So what I'm going to have to instead do is describe them to you. Now, the first of these images, and this is the one I really wanted to cover, is a series of camera traps images. So as you can see with the one on your screen right now, this is saying this was taken on 10/9/2015 at 3:29 a.m. You can see that at the bottom. Now, I should say this is a very sort of basic camera trap camera. So it didn't actually produce this very, very fancy image that I'm talking about. This image is actually my book cover. This is taken from a camera trap. This is the city of Mumbai. And it's this amateur photographer called Nan Kumar Panolkar, who's a friend of mine who's basically giving me this image for the book cover. But he had laid this camera trap in this area in Bombay. And it's again, a very high quality image that emerged from that camera trap. But normally what you have are images like these, which aren't necessarily as aesthetically beautiful as, say, this one. But anyway, let me begin with the first image. So the first image is basically, it shows there are four images. So say 3:29 a.m., 3:30 a.m., 3:31 a.m., 3:32 a.m. So you see them, moving in time in a sort of seconds apart, pretty much, or minutes apart. So the first image, you basically have this man who's sleeping under a mosquito net, and he's sleeping outside his house. Again, this is in a very big city in India. And he's got a lamplight which is sort of close to him. So the light falls quite beautifully on him because you see, it's all darkness, but you see this man sleeping under a mosquito net. That's what you see. The second frame, you see this absolutely beautiful and gorgeous leopard who has come extremely close to the bed where this man is sleeping. He's passed out, he's asleep, he's not noticing nothing. And then you see that there are a few images where you just see the leopard standing there. And then the next image is one where he turns his head. So literally the image is him turning his head away. And then the fourth slide of it is you see the leopard walking away. So the first image is a man sleeping under a mosquito net with this leopard staring at him. Second is he's just sleeping there. Then there's a leopard who comes in, he's looking at him. Then the leopard turns his head away, and then the leopard walks away. And you see this in the sort of, one after the other. Now, when the set of four images was first shown to me by the group of people who had been putting up the camera trap, it was narrated as a moment when the leopard is considering the human as food. The main narrator, who was scrolling through these images with me, read that critical instant when the leopard averts its head as a decision that this meal is not of interest. Now, to me, having heard of so many stories of similar encounters, or rather of even more dangerous ones, as in those, where the humans are awake or conscious, or, where other things happen, such as they're attacked or killed or whatever, these photographs told me a different story. Now, I'm not going to go into what the photographs, how I interpreted them, but it was just a very different story for me. For me, it was basically an interpretation which led me to believe that this is not what's called a crooked cat, which is a cat that's gone off the street in some part to, you know, to adopt a very strange attitude towards humans, but rather one that's straightforward. Now, no doubt other interpretations can be drawn from those photographs. My interest here lies, though, in the fact that these and similar camera trap-enabled photographs are giving us further evidence in a visual and highly aestheticized medium of a fact that, in a way, we already know, namely, that humans and big cats can and do live in close proximity. One might argue that this close sharing of space is not always known thus, especially when one is asleep. However, humans who live in tiger, leopard, or lion territory have other means to gauge such proximity, especially pug marks, but also, you know, sort of, there's a lot of talk about the affect of the environment, what happens when a tiger enters the space or when a leopard is prowling. There's a lot of talk about instinct, about emotion, about the hair standing up at the back of your neck, about being able to feel the gaze of the animal boring into your back. I mean, there are other sort of ways in which people talk about what it is to live in close proximity to them. Now, I should say that, you know, about tigers, because of the dwindling population, you don't really have so many stories in the same way. But you do actually have many, many more for leopards in contemporary India. So historically, there have been some like fantastic stories about tigers and, you know, how you know that they're near you, which again, we'll talk about later on. Now, let's go back to the man who was photographed sleeping under a mosquito net with the leopard watching him. I asked these people whether they'd ever told him about this image or was he ever shown it? And they were like, no, never. Similarly, with when I opened the straw, when I talked about that ledge I was sitting on and there was this leopard sitting there, this was actually a house made of mud, which some Adivasis or, you know, quote unquote, Scheduled tribe people who are, you know, very much on the margins of society and very poor, etc., they live over there. And I asked them, did you ever show them that image, that this leopard is there? Because actually with that image, what you saw was that this leopard was prowling around that house in that area every second night. Like he lived there and he never attacked any humans, as far as I know. He did pick up some domestic dogs and he did pick up cattle, etc. He did attack cattle, but he never did anything to them. But the thing is, the fact is that both the people who actually live in that house, where we were putting up these camera traps and sitting outside, have never been told that this image was taken from their house. And similarly with this person. Let me sort of give you another example of this, of sort of a similar story, and then we can sort of consider it a bit more. In another city I worked in, there was another story that revealed the same ethical issues regarding who owns this newfound camera trap knowledge and when or whether one should inform the individual who has been photographed cheek by jowl with the big cat. So this is another story which, again, you know, I found this very very interesting for several reasons. So this is a story of, you know, these other team of camera trappers that I was working with. They told me about how they were trying to place the cameras in a particular space and they came across a path that leads to a water body. There's a little small lake. I'm just remembering, I can see this again. And it's sort of this very rough path in the woods. And, you know, these camera trappers who are slightly experienced have said to me, they said, you know, this is ideal leopard territory. We know from the census and from pug mark analyses and other camera trap images that there are lots of leopards that live around here. And actually, this would be the right spot for them to be hanging out, especially because there's water over here. And it's hidden enough to camouflage leopards. One of the things that we always do when we're setting up these cameras is that we go and interview people who live over there and say, have you seen a leopard? Have you seen its pug marks? Have you ever felt it? Have any of you ever been attacked by it? And normally, actually, this is really the way to understand where to place the cameras or where to actually locate it, because people who live there are the ones who've seen them the most and have the deepest knowledge of these animals. But this time, basically, they interviewed an elderly gentleman who walks down that same path to the stream every day with his pet dog. This is an important point because leopards prey on dogs. And he walks down to that area every day, and he's been doing it for the past 20 years. So in the evening, he takes a walk, and, you know, the evening again, duskish is the time when it's a good time to spot leopards. And so they asked him whether he had ever spotted a leopard there. And he was just like, no, what are you talking about? I've heard these rumors and this is all nonsense. And, you know, there's no leopard here. Take it from me. I've lived here for 20 years. I go for these walks and I go with my dog. And, you know, dogs are big magnets for leopards, but I've never seen a leopard. And so he basically was like, no way. So the team members told me they were quite disheartened after talking to him because they were like, oh, but he would know because, you know, he's been here for a long time. But they were so convinced that that territory and that park and the water in particular in a very dry region should attract leopards. They said, okay, we'll just put it up. And let's just experiment for a few days. If we get nothing, then we'll move the camera away. Now, what they went on to find was stunning. And again, I've seen these images, but I do not have access to them. And it's absolutely stunning what they found. They found the images from the camera trap showed the same gentleman who had dissuaded them from placing the camera trap there, walking down at his regular hour every evening. So let's say it's about 6 p.m. in the evening that he's going for a walk. 15 to 20 minutes later, they would see a leopard taking the very same path, down towards the water. That's not enough. About half an hour later, yet another leopard, so a distinct new individual, would appear on the same path. So in short, not only was there one, but there were two separate leopards who were in that area, who walked behind the man and evidently were very aware of his presence and that of each other in the territory. So these leopards knew that both of them sort of lived there. They stayed away from each other. They never got into any fights. But importantly, they also stayed away from this person. Now, once again, this person wasn't informed of his ghostly walking companions. The reason given was that it would be too much of a shock and he would get panicked. Also, the leopard wasn't hurting the man, so there was no reason to alert him to their presence. Now, I often think of all these nameless men in these sets of photographs, the man who unknowingly walks with leopards each evening, and the man who quietly slept on as a leopard regarded him studiously for some time. Both images have remained etched in my mind. I dwell on these men not because they're living and breathing, breathtaking proximity to leopards without realizing it. Rather, I'm also made, well, not just that, I'm also made uncomfortable about the fact that I know something that they don't about their own lives, an aspect that can for some be utterly terrifying. Now, what are the reasons for this non-disclosure? They're very complex and they vary depending on whom you speak to. So the citizen conservationists who are, you know, very central to these camera trapping exercises constantly talked about the importance of not causing panic and stress. So this word panic was constantly brought up. They're like, no, they'll panic. It's going to lead to panic in the area. And there was also this argument that, you know, what they don't know will not hurt them, quite literally in this case. Forest officials whom I spoke to had more bureaucratic and preservationist reasons for not revealing the images or details of where and when leopards or tigers are being habitually spotted. And they said this was to prevent potential poaching or some sort of random killing of this highly protected animal. So lions, tigers, leopards are highly protected by the Indian state. For the forester, you know, they would tell me about how, well, it's very critical to guard the life of every leopard and any knowledge that the natives, quote unquote, might have of the movements, habits, and residences of these protected animals could pose a potential threat to them. So a threat to the tigers and leopards and lions. Yet another reason that was given to me by the photographers and camera trappers was related to the image taking process. They said that these images are owned by a particular organization, given that the photos were taken by their equipment. So there was a whole question of copyright, which was loosely understood, which precluded a sharing of that information. So for instance, this image that I'm showing to you, this is actually from a camera trap that I set with another wildlife biologist. And we got some really like stunning sort of images in this particular place that we worked in of tigers and leopards in this area. But this is being published in my book, but I can't own copyright to it, even though I set up the camera, et cetera, because the camera was owned by the state forest department that this image is taken in. So I credit them with it, even though I actually took the image. Well, I didn't take the image, sorry. I located the camera in some way. So, but you know, the point here is that this basically is, it's leading to sort of all sorts of sort of complications. So for instance, I can't even name publicly in the book, for instance, where some of these images are, what the cities are. I cannot name the photographers, I cannot name even the organizations and magazines that are involved in some of these camera trapping exercises due to these ethical concerns. I personally have such disclosures. And so there is sort of, with each of these images, there are some very sort of very complex and contextual, you know, non-disclosure reasons for non-disclosure. I'm going to give you one more example before I sort of move on to the legal questions that this is opening up. And so one of the cities I worked in, there's a leopard that regularly visits the parking lot of a very top sort of 7-star hotel. So this is one of the big, you know, it's sort of one of the big chains that have these very, very high-end hotels. Oops, sorry, I'm jumping ahead. And this, because of the fact that this is a very expensive, you know, place and the 7-star hotels, etc., every inch of that area is under CCTV surveillance. Now, in this particular city, you constantly see that there's one leopard who appears to have sort of a posture for lolling and napping on top high-end Jaguar and BMW cars, because that's the only type of cars that you get in here. And so again, I was working in the forest department in one state, and this complaint would come in from this hotel all the time. They're like, don't you understand? You have foreigners, you have rich people, we have elites, they will name these, you know, big business tycoons and talk about politicians. They live in our hotel, they're coming here. And you have this leopard who every evening he comes and he sleeps across, you know, on top of a Jaguar car, or you see him rolling next to a Mercedes. And I mean, I just cannot tell you how funny some of those images are, because you have this really sleek, big, like Bentley car standing there. And there's a leopard sort of just, you know. And again, I wish I could share these visuals with you, because they are just beautiful and they're sort of sublime in the humor of it. You know, that this really high-end elite cars and this leopard just like running around. And he seems to really enjoy it. Like you see him strolling around, he's inspecting a car, he's napping atop one car, etc. And this causes a sort of a lot of consternation to the hotel owners. And of course, they never ever tell their rich clients that, by the way, you know, at night this is what's happening. And what's interesting is that this leopard is one of those who's very hard to catch. I mean, so I have this whole section on how difficult it is to nab leopards, to physically catch them. It's actually very, very difficult to trap them physically, because they're very light, they're very quick, they're very clever. They sort of slip in and out of things. It's not easy to tranquilize them. It's just, the whole thing is very complicated. So basically, frankly, they can't sort of do anything with it. I also have sort of this like the stories here of, oh my God, I'm rapidly running out of time, so I'm going to run ahead. Of stories of how there are all these, you know, other sort of stories of, you know, points when I couldn't sort of really talk about what was happening here with this. But I think I'm going to skip those, and maybe we can talk about in the Q&A. One of the things I do want to talk about here is something where this question of the copyright image is very, one place where it has been sort of has been discussed more globally or internationally is in now the case of this very famous celebrated monkey selfie case, which revolved around a photograph that a crested black macaque in Indonesia took. And he had taken it himself using the equipment that was owned by the British nature photographer David Slater. The image was used by Wikimedia on the grounds that Slater couldn't hold the copyright to a monkey selfie, and subsequently a bitter legal battle was waged by people for the ethical treatment of animals better, who wanted the macaque to own the copyright to the image. They use the next friend principle, which allows people to sue in the name of another person who's unable to do so. And so the lawsuit is entitled Naruto et al. Versus David Slater, and became globally famous for the fact that a monkey who was named Naruto by PETA was suing for copyright. And anyway, in January 2016, PETA and Slater reached an out-of-court settlement with a joint statement between the two stating that they agree that this case raises important cutting-edge issues about expanding legal rights for non-human animals, a goal that they both support, and they will continue the respective work to achieve this goal. Again, I'm going to skip the section where I talk about how this question of legal personhood, this might be something to discuss perhaps in the Q&A. This question of legal personhood is, we know that it's coming up in the US, we know that it's come up in the European Union, which has already begun to recognize animals as sentient beings in 2009 in an article of the Treaty of Lisbon, etc. We know about the New Zealand case where rivers are being sort of, you know, given personhood, etc. But what perhaps we don't know so well is that even in India, there's a, in Uttarakhand, which is the state that I work in, where I am right now, in the Himalaya right now, the High Court had passed an order saying that the entire animal kingdom, including avian and aquatic, are declared as legal entities, having a distinct persona with corresponding rights, duties, and liabilities as living persons. So these questions regarding the ownership and morality of animal knowledges are beginning to be sort of opened up. And this is, so, you know, this question of, and so what I want to sort of talk about here in, well, what I talk about in greater detail in the chapter, but I'm going to have to skip rapidly now, is this relationship between something like this image, which is a selfie and a way of visualizing, and this question of legal personhood, and, you know, who owns these images, and what does it sort of do, and how the sort of three are sort of very complicatedly interrelated. I want to show you a little video clip. This is, again, something that's in the public domain, so I can show it. And then I'm going to sort of come to sort of, I hope I'm able to. Are you able to see this video clip?
You need to change the screen. You need to stop sharing the screen and then share the screen with the video.
Okay, sorry. Stop sharing this. And I'm going to just show you. Oops. Sorry, it's running ahead. Are you able to see this?
Yes.
Oh no, except now it's sort of, no, sorry, I'm gonna have to. Sorry about this. I just want you to see this because actually it's sort of, it really might show you a bit of, so this is it. I'm gonna put the sound off so that, well, Mumbai gave Bullo T low conclude. I've stopped sharing it, right? So you're not seeing you're seeing me now, sort of the. Yeah? Okay, so I'm assuming you're not seeing the screen anymore. I can't hear anyone, so I'm going to just talk.
It's fine.
No, okay. We are not seeing it.
Okay, great. So I'm going to just end with one story and then I'm going to conclude because I know I'm out of time. This is a story of, like you saw in this video, about this sort of leopard entering and taking this pet dog out. Now, something that, this was basically a nanny cam that had been put up in this high-end apartment in Mumbai, which captured this. Now, something that has come up repeatedly in my field, especially in the last 4 or 5 years, is in these big cities like Mumbai, like Shimla, you know, where you have this new middle class that sort of wants to live in so-called green areas. They go and live in the, you know, near forests, they live near sort of wildlife reserves, etc., which are just on the boundaries of these spaces. And they have a lot of surveillance cameras in the houses because, you know, this is just the way the new middle class in India lives. They're extremely wealthy, often living in in very unequal spaces. And sometimes sort of comes up again and again, are videos exactly like the one you just saw, which is that this surveillance camera is capturing things like, you know, a tiger taking a nap on the courtyard, or very, very commonly a leopard coming into the house and preying on domesticated dogs, pet dogs. And in this one city I worked in, the city of Shimla in Himachal Pradesh, this is actually a huge problem. So leopards don't attack humans there, but they come and prey on dogs. And I'm going to just give you one example, and then I'm going to sort of conclude with a few thoughts. And so in the city that, you know, in Shimla, I can name this because it's an interview. And again, I was going on doing some work and doing some interviews, I met this elderly gentleman who's a retired high court judge who lives in this extremely posh area in Shimla. And he lives alone, and he had a dog who's sort of his pet dog for like 20 years or something before he basically, he saw his dog, very similar to this image in this video that I just showed you from Bombay, his surveillance camera picked up this leopard entering the house and picking up this dog and taking him away. And so when I was interviewing this person, and you know, so the reason I interviewed him was not because this is uncommon, but I interviewed him because he's a very powerful man who then wanted the leopard killed, and he went on this whole retributive sort of drive to capture him, to cause his things. It all failed for a variety of complicated reasons, and the leopard, they could never track him down, they could never do anything to him, etc. But this person, when I met him, he sort of in his room, he showed me this video clip on loop again and again and again. And I think the seventh or eighth time that he showed it to me, he started crying, like weeping, and saying, "This is what happened to my dog. You know, see what this beast did. See what, you know." And it was an extremely painful sort of meeting, an extremely painful interview. And I can't forget his tears. And I write about that in some detail, that those tears that roll down his cheek have meaning, that they have political and social effects of all sorts of forms that are sort of written out this entire conservationist literature. So I'm going to just end with a few lines. These new ways of seeing big cats produce a range of emotions that go well beyond the project of conservationism, even as they aid our understanding of how big cats live, and particularly how closely to us they do so. What is intimacy, if not the presence of two leopards that walk safely behind a human with a regularized frequency? What is intimacy, if not the big cat that so carefully considers the human as he sleeps under his mosquito net, or the leopard that lounges comfortably on the ledge of another person's hut? Similarly, the anguish you feel watching your beloved pet being dragged off by a murderous leopard, or the sympathy that is generated for a leopard trapped in a well — I didn't have time to talk about leopards trapped in wells, which is another big sort of motif and a big sort of occurrence that is happening now in India, and there's a lot of work around it. So I'm sorry, I had to skip that. But what is, the sympathy that is generated for a leopard trapped in a well is what allows us to know that this predator with an intensity, albeit through opposing emotions of hate and love. But the question of what happens to these images produced by camera traps or to video clips that are often inadvertently captured by CCTV remains open. I can only speculate on what they may become, with this uncertainty over the near future, which, as we know, constitutes a core feature of life in the Anthropocene. One doesn't know what will be, quite literally, tomorrow, but one is constantly guessing at it. So what are the questions that are opened up by these new forms of entrapment of big cats in India? They include questions about potential legal developments, such as the conferring of legal of rights and legal personhood to animals, questions of science and conservation as they intersect in the race to maintain species diversity and prevent extinction, and ethical and moral conundrums around ideas of native panic and senses of safety in a landscape. All three of these aspects require a radical reimagining of what it means to share space with big cats in the age of the Anthropocene. The changing modalities of visualizing the beast and the range of emotions and visceral responses they unleash in the process are not merely unintended side effects of the new leaps in digital conservation. On the contrary, conservationism and human relations with the non-human world will be, and indeed already are, as the legal challenges and emerging questions are showing, profoundly reshaped by the seemingly peripheral tears that roll down an elderly man's face as he watches his beloved pet dog being preyed on by the big cat that lives down the road. Okay, I'm going to end. Sorry if I went over a bit.
Thank you.